There are roughly 400 criminal investigation laboratories scattered across the United States. We checked. We can extrapolate that perhaps that means there are thousands of crime labs around the world, and exactly one is dedicated to the solving of crimes against wildlife. That lab belongs to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and is located in Ashland, Oregon. Today's guest is the boss, and he's got some tales to tell about the lab and his work in and out of it. Ken Goddard wears lots of hats, the day job being his leadership at the forensics lab. In his spare time, he's managed to work as a police officer and investigator, stay married, raise a daughter, and write a pile of books. Ken Goddard, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Ever had your life described quite so briefly?
That's a different point of view of the whole thing, sure.
I noticed that the lab is, I just checked out the website yesterday, full for volunteers for the summer. So a lot of interest, but what do volunteers do at the lab?
A lot of work. We try to bring on 5, 6, 7, 8 student volunteers predominantly and get them involved in our research. The idea, we really we're so focused on our casework. There's so much research we're trying to do to push the envelope. Ideally, from our standpoint, we get them in young enough so that by the time they graduate here from SOU, they have their degree in one hand and their first published paper in the other, because we give them credit for their work.
Really? Published papers and everything?
Sure.
When you say pushing the envelope, in what sense?
Well, our science is new. You know, those 400 crime labs, their victim is a person, a human. In our case, it's pretty much every other non-human animal that's either endangered, threatened, or protected. And it can be anywhere on the planet. We can't make assumptions as to where an item of evidence came from.
This is the only lab of its kind anywhere on the planet. So, I mean, are you constantly getting asked for tours and interviews? And thank you, by the way, for coming out again.
This is fun. Happy to do this. I like being on the radio. Sadly, we can't have public tours because one of the investigative information that's literally out on our tables. Two, we have to worry about disease vectors. We have bio-level 3 facilities in the laboratory. Most of the diseases involving the animals aren't dangerous to us humans, but every now and then, there can be issues from Africa, and there's bioterrorism, somebody deliberately infecting a wild or domestic herd. So we do have to be alert.
Wow. So is there a heavy security there or something?
We have an interesting security system, but it's mostly us. You know, we're not armed investigators. We're forensic scientists. Our job is to speak for the evidence. And what does the evidence say? And not take sides. I think that's one of the hardest things for a young forensic scientist to understand when they come to our lab. They're not to be an advocate. In fact, if they're members of environmental organizations, we strongly suggest they resign their membership. To the extent that they're perceived as having a bias, that doesn't help. The courts expect us to speak only for the evidence, answer questions for prosecution and defense. When we're done, we shake hands, we leave the court, we check out of our hotel, come back here, and start on the next case and never ask how the trial went. The idea being, from my standpoint, certainly a gold star on the wall is a successful presentation, not a successful prosecution.
Really? So there's no high-fiving when you convicted somebody or anything?
No. I mean, if we've put a bad guy away, if we've helped do that, wonderful. You know, that's what we're here for. But the evidence may show that that's not the suspect. That's not the bad guy, or the evidence simply doesn't go far enough. And if it doesn't, we say so.
How do you then, as scientists, make the separation between hypothesis and assumption?
Well, hypothesis is an integral part of the scientific method. You start with a hypothesis, you create tests, you develop data.
But it is an I think that this is what's going to happen kind of
well,
thing, isn't it?
Well, you may have an idea, but you should be – it's very crucial that you're open to all the data. You don't discard data just because it doesn't match your idea of things. You only assess at the end. It's an interesting twist on the game.
And is this something that is advocated in – I mean, you've worked in other crime labs, right?
Sure. Yeah, I was early on. I had no intention of being one, but because of a judo accident, I graduated in biochemistry from the University of California at Riverside.
Wait, but the judo accident caused you to graduate?
Well, it actually caused me to become a cop. I was going to need a job. I'd met this lovely young gal and talked her into getting married. I was about to graduate in biochem. I didn't like it. It's boring. You have pipette all over the place. And, and I was poor. I had two jobs, this lovely girlfriend. about to graduate. I'm working out in judo to make myself feel better. Got hurt in a match. The serendipitous situation, the instructor taking me to the hospital was a Riverside County Sheriff's Sergeant. He knew about Gina, and he said, "Hey, do you ever think about being a cop?" And I said something to the effect, "Well, I can't even win in a fair fight." He said, no. He said, "This is CSI, forensics, but you got to be a deputy sheriff to protect yourself." My new pathway in life.
So how did, of all the places in the world, why Ashland, Oregon? Aside from the fact that Mark Hatfield was a very powerful U.S. senator at the time.
He was, but it took the inspiration of a chiropractor, Dr. Ralph Wanger, who heard about us looking for a site for our laboratory. We had very little money. There were 8 or 9 sites. And when he heard about us, he went to Senator Hatfield and Packwood and said, "Look, this is an environmental issue. Oregon's an environmental state. You ought to get it here." And they amazingly, one, listened to him, two, went to the Secretary of Interior to see how they could do it, thereby triggering an investigation on me because it appeared that I had lobbied 2 very powerful senators. And my response was, if I knew how to lobby, I'd have done so a long time ago.
So did you lobby for the lab to get to Oregon?
No, I'm a federal government employee. I'm not allowed.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I was to work for the NGO groups. But Dr. Wanger came out of left field. And the next thing I know, I'm being sent out here to see if this would work. And I'm standing roughly where that forensics garden is in front of our laboratory, looking around saying, wow. I called my wife up that evening and said, "Look, it's beautiful, but it's not going to happen. This isn't what they do to you in the federal government."
And yet...
I was wrong.
You were wrong. Ken Goddard's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the boss at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland, the only lab of its kind on the planet. We'll come back and talk more with Ken. If you'd like to visit, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Goddard and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Ken Goddard. He is the boss at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory, based in Ashland, Oregon, the only laboratory of its kind in the world, performing investigations on crimes against wildlife. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Ken about his life at the lab and his life outside of it. He's written 11 books. I finally got him to nail down a number for me. 11 books he's written, and he has also acted as a consultant to the CSI TV show, which we'll get to down the road. Join us here at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. So you were just saying you didn't think that this would happen, that they'd go for Ashland, Oregon as the site for this lab.
No reason in the world to think it would. This was a little out-of-the-way place. They had 8 other sites that they wanted, and Ashland came out of the blue. I had no clue as to how powerful the 2 senators were. I gave my report, and 3 months later, they called me up and said, "Get on an airplane. It's Ashland." Wow.
So what were you doing? What was the previous job?
Well, I was by the time I had applied for this, I was running a crime lab for the Huntington Beach Police Department, a scientific investigation bureau, investigating major crime scenes, working drugs, doing the classic police stuff, and getting thoroughly depressed at the whole thing. I was getting tired of seeing dead kids on a morgue slab, especially when they're the same age as my daughter, and especially when the father was a suspect. I just didn't compute well. And I got to a point where I told my wife, "I got to find something else. I just do." And this advertisement for somebody to set up a crime lab for Fish and Wildlife Service showed up in one of the police magazines. And my wife said, "Hey, look at this. You ought to apply." And I said, "Well, I don't know much about wildlife. I mean, it's, you know, we have seagulls out here. That's about it in San Diego area." And she said, no, do it. Well, it turned out they wanted a writer. They wanted somebody to write the CSI manuals, the evidence handling manuals, because they were a relatively new law enforcement agency. I think that's why I was hired. But when I got back there in D.C. and wrote the manuals and said, "Okay, let's get the lab going," they said, "Well, we need to talk to you about that. We don't have any money for a laboratory." it's your job to lobby for it. I said, well, okay, how do I do that? And they said, well, that's the problem. It's illegal for you to do that. You've got to work with the NGO groups. There's a dance to be learned. And in the meantime, you're going to drive us crazy around here. So here's a badge, a gun, put together a CSI kit and a surveillance kit. We want you out in the field helping the agents. So for 7 years, I'm wherever our special agents were doing something fun. If it hadn't been for Gina and Michelle, dear wife and daughter, I don't know if we'd have a lab. I'd still be out there having fun.
But the interesting, though, the idea of spurring on the NGOs, you had to kind of get them to talk outside of school to them, and then they had to come back in and lobby the
Well, I was allowed to talk to NGO groups to try and encourage them and to get this going. They're the ones who can lobby the politicians and get the staffers to call me up and ask me questions, which I'm allowed to answer.
Ah.
The dance.
Ah, it really is a dance. So since this is the only forensics lab for wildlife crimes in the world, I mean, I have to believe the workload is probably quite consistent.
It's a bit overwhelming, to put it mildly. And it's gotten worse because of wood, planks. We're told fairly recently to figure out how to identify wood when it's no longer a tree. Endangered species woods, rosewoods, auger woods. You can easily identify a tree based, well, I say that casually. I'm not a tree expert or botanist, but a true botanist can identify a tree based on its bark, its leaves, its flowers, fruit, all that stuff. But when you've turned it into a piece of lumber, a 2x4, and then you've kiln-dried it, not only have you lost species-defining characteristics, but you killed the DNA. We have amazingly come up with techniques where we can identify a plank back to not only to a species, but where it grew up.
Really? So you can figure out the location?
Yes.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing technology. Good old Espinoza. He's constantly coming up with clever things.
Let's give full credit. What's his name?
Dr. Ed Espinoza, the chief scientist, and as far as I'm concerned, the scientific soul of our lab.
That's great. And I understand that there was a process involving identifying woods that had got involved in a case against a guitar company.
Yeah, we didn't because we weren't ready for it. They called us up and said, hey, can you identify rosewood? And we said, no, we're bunnies and guppies. You know, that's a tree. They said, well, okay, good thing we've got, you know, a paper trail and other things. But ultimately to take on, you know, especially the people clear-cutting forests, in the international community. They're not only taking down the trees, thousands of trees, but they're destroying habitat. They're endangering all kinds of species, and our job is to, you know, when they intercept a containerized cargo shipment with, let's say, 300 cargo bins all full with lumber, our job is to figure out what it is and where it came from.
I get the sense, though, that people probably wouldn't work at the lab unless they did care about wildlife and environmental destruction and things like that.
Oh, I think that's probably true. I think that's an initial, you know, gee, I'd like to do this. And then I think there's a little bit of a jarring effect when we tell them you can't be emotionally involved. You got to back that off. You know, I mean, what you do in your private life is your business. That's perfectly fine. But once you're in the laboratory, you got to put those blinders up. You just got to focus on the evidence. And as a scientist, tell the investigators, tell the courts what it means and what it doesn't mean.
So given the crush of business there, I mean, do you have to turn some business away or put things on the back burner, or is there a delay in getting information through the lab?
Yeah, we're constantly telling people, you know, well, okay, you've got 100 items. Well, we can't analyze all 100 items. How about picking 10? Will that get you, you know, through to your court system? But then one of our agents sees 3,000 pairs of boots and shoes made out of theoretically endangered species, and the judge ordered us to identify all 3,000 pair. When a federal judge tells you to do something, we say yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and we do it. We got in 500 Totoaba fish bladders worth $5,000 to $6,000 a piece, which we had to figure out just based on the swim bladder, what the fish was. We hadn't done that before. Fortunately, one of
us. So that's the only part you had was the bladders?
That's all we had. They're worth $5,000 to $6,000 in Asia, in China.
As what?
Asian medicinals.
Oh, okay. The medicinals, we have much more to talk about there. Ken Goddard's our guest in the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the work at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab. Here's a call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. I talked to you a couple of years ago when you were on, asking how CSI TV and NCIS, with all the bells and whistles, can do stuff immediately. And you said that was pretty much fiction. Well, have you gotten any new equipment in the last couple of years that is speeding you up, or are you still struggling along?
Well, science is science. I mean, you can only do things so fast. DNA analysis just is going to take, 24 or 48 hours. We've got a DART instrument that's mind-boggling in what it can do, and that's we use that to identify wood. But the thing they get wrong in there is what these CSIs are and what they're not in reality. There's no such thing as a CSI, crime scene investigator, forensic scientist, and detective. Those are two very different fields, and they must be.
So they wouldn't be out there picking up the stuff in addition to processing?
Well, I was a CSI forensic scientist, deputy sheriff, but only to protect myself. The last guy I wanted to see at my crime scene was the bad guy. I sure as heck wasn't going to yell at him, shoot at him, chase him, and yell and interrogate him. Not my job. My job is to work the evidence. So they really twist it around, and the CSIs actually don't engage with crime labs. If they're working at night, the lab's closed. If they bring something in the morning, the forensic scientists, the Grissoms, are working on evidence from 3 months ago. They don't want to hear about your problems today. But, the instrumentation, they get the technology pretty much correct. It's the timing and who's who that they don't quite get right.
So you don't watch the show, I guess.
I don't, which made it difficult when they asked me to write one of the books. I said, sure. I said, but I don't watch the show. I can't suspend my disbelief enough. And they said, we'll send you the episodes. And they sent me 5 years of episodes.
Talk about binge watching.
Well, my wife and I started, and we skipped a lot. And then I wrote the manuscript, and they called me up, and they said, hey, Ken, we got some problems. There's not enough GSRs in your book. And the GSRs, to me, are gunshot residues.
Okay.
And I said, well, that's not really right, because there's a whole bunch of gunshot residues in that manuscript. They said, no, this is Gil and Sarah relationships.
Oh.
I said, they had a relationship? And they said, you didn't watch all those episodes, did you? I said, no, I didn't.
I didn't get up to season 3 or something.
Well, I saw a couple in season 4 and 5, but I missed the old relationship, and I had to go back and put in some more GSRs to the point I could stand it.
It was interesting because when I realized that you had written one of the books in the companion CSI book series that goes with the TV show, I just out of curiosity checked to see online to see what people had said about it, and I noticed a lot of people were saying the same thing. It's like, well, this sure is detailed on the on the investigation part of things.
Yeah, where's the relationship? Where's the emotions? I thought, well, wait a minute, that's we're CSIs. We're not supposed to be running around with each other. We're supposed to be on our hands and knees working the evidence. I mean, I remember several years ago, I was on my hands and knees on the third or fourth hour thinking, I could write a TV treatment on this. And I thought, well, who would watch this? My God.
Ken Goddard's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He runs the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland, Oregon, the only lab investigating crimes against wildlife in the whole wide world. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the question that Steve and Eugene asked from our phone call.
I hope he keeps calling in. This is fun.
He calls a lot. The equipment you have, I mean, when you talked about the kind of stuff that Ed Espinosa is coming up with, like the device that can, or the process anyway, that can identify wood, recover DNA from stuff that's actually been dried in kilns.
Well, he's using something called a DART, direct analysis in real time. It's a mass spectrograph, but normally with a mass spec, you have to turn your unknown into a liquid or gas and then inject it. Well, this has a plasma gas generator that generates a stream of gas at extremely high temperature. You put your sample into that stream with forceps, because you'd burn your finger off.
Your fingertips.
That plasma gas etches off a small amount of, let's say, a pill. 5 seconds later, the components of that pill are up on the screen. To me, it's magic.
Wow.
I mean, it just is. And he's doing that with the wood. He's pulling the oils out of the wood planks. And if we can get it down visually microscopically by Gabby, with our wood anatomist, to family, then Ed can get it to genus and species, because there's a few that he has to distinguish. And all of a sudden, we've got a technique that, in fact, he's heading out to Europe next week to help teach what he's doing to a bunch of wood anatomists who thought their science had come to a halt at family. They had no clue that you could do instrumental analysis on a plank.
So he really pulled back the curtain on a whole other process.
Oh, he did.
Which raises the question I was shooting for, which was about how hard it is to find equipment that goes directly to what you do at the lab. And it sounds like what Ed Espinoza and people like him do is they figure out ways to use existing gadgets with new processes.
Precisely. Yeah, we got the DART for a whole separate purpose. It was Ed's brain, you know, going out there on the perimeters saying, I wonder what would happen if. Of the 7-8 major discoveries of our lab, most of them are his because of how that brain of his works. You never know what he's going to come up with, and that makes my days interesting.
So there's not just you know, you've written some crime dramas, 11 books altogether here, and you mentioned that you got hired for the job because they needed a writer to come up with the
I'd written
stuff on
CSI and, you know, done it for a long time, sure.
But the original process of writing, I mean, were you writing to get out the stuff you were experiencing at work? You talked about how tough it was.
I was writing for mental health. I got some really good advice early on when I was in the Sheriff's Academy, a young kid who really was out of place. I'm a skinny, you know, 6 foot, 150, 60-pound scientist amongst these brutes. And the training sergeant came stomping in and said, where's this forensics guy? I got to make it into a deputy. And his eyes locked on me. And he said, oh, no.
He figured you out right away.
He did. But I got some I got some really good training because he was convinced I wasn't going to survive, that I would think I was too smart, that I would, you know, that I could talk the criminals off as opposed to if they don't do what I told them, dump them. I have an A-B switch now. He did a really good job. I'm a gentle guy. But I got this wonderful training from these two grizzled sergeants who were sitting there knitting. And I came up and said, what are you doing? Knitting? I'm sure they were doing that just to draw in, you know, idiots to ask them that question. But they said, oh, yeah, you're the forensics kid. Come here, sit down. We need to talk to you. The essence of the talk was if I wanted to stay married, if I wanted to stay out of bars, not have boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever, I needed something else to come home to. Art, music, carpentry, projects to focus on so I didn't end up in bars grousing about how bad the day was, and all of a sudden that's what I did. And writing was it for me, telling stories, Frog and the Princess stuff. It was mental health, certainly. I needed it then for some of the gruesome things I was seeing. I don't need it now. My life is much better.
A lot less gruesome, yeah.
Yes.
But in fact, the original novels were fairly gory, I understand. In fact, you provide a warning on your website.
I do, be cautious. You know, hold on to your heart with a couple of them. It's where it took me as a young kid. And, young forensic scientist, CSI, you know, whatever I was. And some of it was pretty horrific. I had, but your mind puts up barriers, amazingly. You learn to treat the body as a piece of furniture.
It's evidence.
Yeah. In fact, one of the more embarrassing things I had happen, three of us were working a crime scene, and we're trying to figure it out. The guy had been killed in his house, and we couldn't find any source of entry, any source of the bullet hole. You know, how did it happen? And we're sitting there looking at each other's notes. We all looked down and realized we had our feet up on the body as a footstool. And it was embarrassing, not because it was furniture, but we were getting footprints, and we had to quickly brush them off.
Yikes.
That's what your life can get like.
I can imagine. Ken Goddard's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab in Ashland. Here's Dean in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in the ivory trade and what might be happening with the elephants in Africa. I'm just so appalled at China buying ivory in the quantities, and I'm sure it's being bought here in the United States too, and the diminishing elephant population in Africa. Is anything being done about that? I'd really like to do something to help.
Yes, well, first of all, he's absolutely right. You know, we go back and forth between being number one and number two users, buyers of the ivory.
In the United States.
In the United States. There's a lot is going on. We at the laboratory have been going to Africa, training African rangers on how to work elephant and rhino crime scenes. I'm going to be heading to Southeast Asia this summer to do the same kind of training to marine and wildlife officers in 4 or 5 Southeast Asian countries. Hopefully we're helping. We're providing techniques to bring suspects to court. We're providing means of identifying the materials. It's, you know, it's pretty obviously an elephant tusk when you have the whole tusk. It's not so obvious when you have a little carving. And that's the nature of our job, to figure out the pieces, parts, and products.
I understand from reading elsewhere that the elephant poachers have turned to bows and arrows so that they don't make the loud report of a gunshot and draw the attention of rangers. So they're coming up with new techniques to outwit the law all the time.
And poisoning and helicopters get in and get out fast. A whole different ballgame, and we're having to keep up. Amazingly, the CSI techniques actually work. We work the kill sites. We get tissue from the victim, the animal, and we're going to be able to match that up to a tusk or a horn down the road if we can intercept it.
And can you figure out where the elephant or rhino lives?
To some degree. The technology isn't up to the CSI TV programs, but we're getting there. We just had an undercover investigation called Operation Crash where over 200 rhino horns were seized, and the sad part is they're worth $150,000 in Asia. And they're worth so much money, several of the horns we intercepted had been sawed off of museum mounts in England.
Really?
Yeah, they broke in, burglarized the museum to saw off the horns.
Wow, it's amazing the extent that people will go through to get rhino horn and tusks.
Money.
More questions about that down the road for Ken Goddard, the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. We'll take a short break on the exchange and come back and finish our chat with Ken. You can join in at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org or check out Ken's smiling face on our Facebook page. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Goddard and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest today is Ken Goddard. He's the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory located in Ashland, Oregon. It is the only wildlife or crime laboratory performing forensic investigation on crimes against animals in the whole world. And Ken's the head of it, has been since the beginning. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like to take part. 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. How long has the lab been open now?
I got here in 86, looking at that beautiful bare ground. We started building in 87. The lab was done in 88 and started hiring in 89 and worked our first case in 89. So that's been,
26 years.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It really has. I'm wondering about the storage of stuff like, you know, the tusks and the horns and, mm-hmm. and the tortoise shells and the pelts and all the other stuff you come in contact with. And I wonder if when you're done with things, if there's an opportunity to present them over across the street there at Science Works Hands-On Museum for the kids.
We have done some of that, certainly. And most of it gets the seized items of evidence. The courts make them government property, and we get them over to our central repository in Denver where the technicians there get the materials out to museums, zoos, educational facilities to help people understand.
Central repository conjures up images like the closing scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where they put the Ark back in a huge warehouse.
It's very much like that. It's just a little bit more horrific in terms of wildlife.
I can imagine. So back to what we were just talking about, though, with elephants and rhinos, for example. I mean, given what you know about what's going on in the world and the numbers of cases that present evidence at the lab, do you think elephants and rhinos are going to make it?
They don't stand much of a chance. I mean, if I were talking about betting, I'd bet against it. There's too much money. $150,000 for a rhino horn. I mean, how do you protect an animal that needs to free roam? I mean, you can, I guess, protect it in a zoo, although people have gone into zoos to kill the animals for the ivory, for the horn. We got to get people to understand that it's a foolish idea that you take rhino horn and it's going to be a health restorative. I mean, if you're curious out there about the rhino horn effects, chew your fingernails, keratin, same stuff.
Same thing.
Absolutely the same stuff.
I was surprised to read there was a story about a year or two ago about training some people from other parts of the world for interdicting people who are trading in things like rhinoceros horn. And even one of the investigators grabbed a little bit of the horn.
Oh, yeah.
Stuck it in his mouth along
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, we have to adjust to our visitors a little bit anyway. We do a lot of training. We get a lot of international scientists here, which we think is a great idea. We're hoping other labs like ours get created. There's a handful of small labs at the state level, one person usually doing some DNA analysis. But in terms of a full crime lab to take on the whole gamut of the evidence, sadly we are it. And we're trying to talk other nations, other continents, into creating at least something sort of like ours so we have other brains, other hands to engage with.
So, I mean, some of these other smaller labs you mentioned, have you helped them get equipped and work on, I mean, share your manual
with
them?
In fact, the early wildlife labs, the one-person labs, were in our six states, and they helped me get our lab going. It's a mutual helping each other situation.
Let's take some calls here. We have, John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Goddard.
Hi. Sounds like you write crime stories. Is that correct?
Sort of. I guess that's the right word for them.
Well, I guess kind of my funny comment is that I want your comment on TV crime shows. For instance, I always thought Law and Order is realistic because it's about just regular New York City people, average folks, right?
Yeah, they do a nice job.
A lot of these other shows are always about people who are rich. Who, let's face it, the rich do occasionally commit a crime, but it's pretty unrealistic.
Yeah.
And one other comment about Perry Mason. I used to watch Perry Mason. I thought it was a cool show. But then I thought, wait a minute, in Perry Mason, the defense always wins. And in reality, not the opposite.
Generally,
it's about rich people. And nobody jumps up from the gallery and says, I did it.
not in my experience, no.
Anyway, I just appreciate your comment.
Thanks, John.
Sure. And the obvious comment from my standpoint, the TV's shows aren't realistic for the most part in terms of the activity. I think they're realistic in terms of the people and some of the technology. But at some point, you're being dramatic. One of the sad things that's happening from the forensic point of view is a bunch of bad work out there where scientists have said, for example, you can positively identify a person with a single hair. You can match that back to a specific individual. And that's complete nonsense.
Really?
Yeah, you can't. No way. There's nothing on the scale patterns of a hair that's individualistic amongst 3 billion people.
Is there no DNA in the hair?
Oh, the DNA, sure. But there wasn't DNA technology back then.
Oh, okay.
But they were still making those calls. This hair found in the crime scene was from this guy, and then he's on death row.
Which reminds me, though, we're just looking up Wayne Williams recently, the Atlanta case,
Atlanta
multiple murders, and that was based heavily on fiber evidence, wasn't it?
Certainly. And then the question is, the technologies are there. What do they mean? What do the statistics mean? If you say something is consistent with, you got to be careful with those words. It implies that it matches. Well, mm-hmm. consistent with means blonde hair, and the victim's hair and the suspect's hair were blonde. They're consistent. Yeah, you got to define your terms better. It's a very dangerous thing for scientists to do in the courtroom, and that's why we're very careful about our training of our scientists. If they're to testify, they're to explain to the jury precisely what their work means.
So what do you make as a scientist of the process that appears to happen where when a new technology comes out and it's like, hey, look, we have this new way for identifying people who perpetrated crimes, and it seems like all of a sudden, boom, every case is using that same kind of evidence, the fibers and then the DNA.
The DNA, later. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, there's a Supreme Court decision called Daubert, and Daubert requires, among other things, that you use well-established technology, well-established science to do your work. Well, in our case, our well-established science may be something Espinoza came up with 2 weeks ago. It isn't really what Daubert had in mind, and it does require that we seek out opposing views, a peer review of it. We have to publish what we do. So we're often desperately trying to publish a new technique, get out there, if it's on rhino horn, get amongst the rhino horn experts who might know if we made a mistake before we ever use it in a trial.
And how many papers come out of that place in a year?
A lot. We probably have 10, 15, 20 publications in a year. We've got, 15 scientists. They're busy. Those students help tremendously. We work them half to death, and we teach them what scientific research is all about, and they end up smiling. It's lovely to see.
Let's take another call. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Goddard from the Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab.
Jeff, Ken, I did it. I did it.
We're looking for you shortly.
There you have it.
Turn around, please.
I think I may have a solution for the poaching situation. Let's convince the Asians that ground leg bones of poachers have a medicinal quality.
I think you have potential as a fiction writer, sir. You might want to dig at that story a bit.
Well, I do have to deal with significant others, so I'm pretty good at fiction. The other piece, though, the serious piece, I'm wondering if you're seeing, as you're examining these creatures that are coming through, are you seeing more evidence of environmental stress? Are you seeing more evidence of chemical toxicity or long-term mutation or damage as a result of chemicals and just general environmental degradation? Yeah.
One section of our laboratory will see that, and that's our veterinary pathology section of our lab. We have two veterinary pathologists, Tabitha and Becky, who determine how and why an animal died. And as they do the classic human-type autopsy, it's called a necropsy on a non-human animal, and they will open that animal up. They'll look at the outside, inside. They'll take tissue samples, blood, urine, liver, kidney samples, to try to figure out, you know, what happened to that animal. And they often find out that it was weakened by environmental contamination, but that wasn't necessarily what killed it. It just made it more vulnerable to dying.
Are the poaching and endangered species cases the bulk of the work you do there?
Pretty much, yeah. It varies a lot, but it really depends on, you know, where the investigator's at. You know, if you're down in Louisiana, you're not getting too many moose cases. And we don't, you know, get many walrus cases out of the guys in Massachusetts. It varies tremendously by location. And now that we're doing a lot of work internationally, it's pretty mind-boggling. We never know what's coming into the lab on any particular day. It's kind of like Christmas in a macabre sort of way.
Opening a new package every day.
Sure. Yeah. Several, actually.
No doubt. Let's go to Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Goddard.
Hello there. Thank you. I was wondering if you are able to track and keep records of how these crimes are prosecuted and if there is punishment that these people receive if they're successfully prosecuted. And by punishment, I would also like to hear the distinction of just another series of fines, which they have tons of money to pay, or is it actual restitution for the damage they've caused?
That information is collected in some detail, but we don't know it on purpose. We don't want the emotions of investigation to impact our analysis of the evidence, which is why I tell our scientists, testify, come back, work on the next case. Don't call up the investigator. Don't call up and see, you know, if the guy was found innocent or guilty. That's not your problem. Your problem is to have spoken for the evidence. If you did so, the likelihood, if that was a real suspect, that was the guy who committed the crimes, the likelihood is the jury will find in that direction. But we have a different role in the courtroom system, and it's real important we stay away from those emotions.
So the strokes you get from the job are about doing good science?
Yes, of course.
Not about closing
and
the case.
We hear from our agents every now and then. They'll say, hey, couldn't have done it without you, and that makes us smile. Mm-hmm. But, okay, come on, guys, you know, back to it. You know, next box of evidence. Let's go.
So sheer numbers. You mentioned 15 scientists and a bunch of interns at the wildlife laboratory.
And 15 support staff.
15 support staff.
Without whom we would never handle the paperwork, much less anything else.
And so how many cases come through in a year?
Probably typically 400, 500, 600. Varies tremendously. Probably 14,000, 15,000, 16,000 items. Varies tremendously, and we're probably 2-3 months behind at a particular time, depending on the type of case. When a BP oil spill situation happens, all of a sudden we have 200 pelicans in our freezers to determine cause of death. That takes a while, but that was a fascinating case.
I can imagine, but that's a lot of freezer space you have to maintain, a lot of cold storage in general.
Yes, we sometimes have to adapt, and we tell the agents only send us so much. You know, keep it there until we've cleaned out our freezers. But yeah, we're prepared for large volumes, sadly.
So you're around so many parts of dead animals. I mean, how do you get along with living animals yourself?
Well, I'm blessed to have a friend named Dave Sidden who runs a place called Wildlife Images.
Yeah.
And early on, you know, his dad said, look, the government's probably going to drive you nuts, right? I said, yeah, that's a good chance of that. He said, come on out here. I'll let you be a chew toy for a grizzly bear. Okay, that sounds interesting. I didn't believe him.
And that's Grizz, right?
That was Grizz, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I got to be a chew toy. It was an amazing experience to have an animal that size, that power and strength, who wanted play, who wanted affection. It was an act of faith, and my wife didn't think much of my idiocy, but wonderful years.
I remember Dave Sidden Sr. He's since passed on, but him wrestling with Grizz. I mean, Dave was very TV reporter friendly at a time when I was reporting in TV.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's got great images out there, and his son does now. Dave Sidden Jr. runs the place.
And I laughingly said, yeah, I wrestled with him, too, probably, 150 times, but it wasn't wrestling. It was him bouncing me around. I mean, I was like wrestling a diesel truck. But he was affectionate. He wanted play. The only time it got out of hand was when I hopped into his big tub of water 10 foot across because he got me all muddy. And I asked Dave, you think it'd be okay? He said, I don't know. Nobody's ever done it. So I hopped in. He stared at me, and he hopped in the tub with me and nuzzled me. And then he put his paw on my head and slammed me underwater. I had set bear play into motion.
Uh-huh.
Apparently bears in that water situation push each other underwater. I wasn't up to that game. I got out of the tub pretty quickly.
I can imagine. Wow. So was he defanged, declawed?
No. He had all his teeth, all of his claws, which he would drape over my head and nuzzle and lick me. Great. Act of faith, like I said.
Yeah, great time with a grizzly bear. So, Ken, ultimately, how much longer will you keep working at the Wildlife Laboratory?
Well, my dear wife has a shovel and wheelbarrow waiting for me when I retire. I've got some really smart people in the lab to do the hard thinking, and I get sent all over the world to meet fun people. So I'm going to hang on to that as long as I can. I don't know, a couple of years probably. I've got to do other things, get out of the way so other people can run the laboratory. I don't think Espinosa wants to do it. He loves the science. He'd rather I deal with the bureaucracy.
And any more books on the way?
I think so, but I'm having so much fun with my granddaughter, who is a freshman here at the local university, that I've kind of set all that aside. I kind of missed out on a lot of my daughter's early life doing crime scenes, so I'm going to enjoy my granddaughter.
All right. It's always good to visit with you, and your job is ultimately, endlessly fascinating, at least to those of us who don't do it.
I do love it.
Ken Goddard is the director at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. Thanks again for joining us on
Thank
the exchange.
Thank you, Jerry.